True Crime Today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure, until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed, for what?
Welcome to the program. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any episodes of our show or breaking updates. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod for updates on the case as well off the air. Today on the program, we're going to be sitting down with a licensed psychologist, John Della Torre. We're going to dive into the psychology of the case now that we have gone through the affidavit, the probable cause affidavit for his arrest, and learned much more about the alleged behavior of Brian prior to the murders taking place, and exactly how an individual can go from leading a very productive seeming life in terms of his professional world and his education to committing a crime like this. What does it take? How does a mind move from point A to point B in what seems to be such a seamless turn, including once the crime was committed, going back to that previous life without missing a beat? Lots of speculation, lots of talk about does Brian Koberger have some sort of mental health condition? What would that be? And tons of things are being floated around. John Della Torre, thank you for joining us. I know in some other reports that you've talked on that in your professional opinion, you don't see any clear signs of any psychiatric disorder with the alleged suspect. Let's start there. Could you provide a little more explanation on your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think for me, the issue comes down to how this whole thing can even unfold. Essentially, what we're saying when someone is suffering from active psychotic symptoms or active symptoms of a serious mental illness of any kind is that there is a level of disorganization that comes along with it.
Okay.
What I mean by that is essentially what happens when someone is suffering from a mental illness is that it's impairing their ability to interact in some area of life, which means that any one of us could be suffering from depressive or anxiety, even psychotic or delusional symptoms. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't impair us, right? We're still able to get up. We're still able to go to work. We're still able to do things that kind of are consistent with the social contract that we've all signed, which is we get up, we go to work, we do all of these kinds of things. What we see here is that there is a disruption in that, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning that this guy, whoever it was, whether it's Koberger or not, has decided that they're going to go outside that social contract and engage in a behavior that the society has decided is illegal. In our case, it's murder. But going about it in such a meticulous and deliberate way, usually that if someone is suffering from active psychotic symptoms or active symptoms like mania or something like that, there's a chaos that's associated with it. There's all kinds of things that a person would leave evidence-wise. There's all kinds of things that would suggest that someone is clearly just engaging in behaviors that they wouldn't normally engage in, that there's just some disruption, and I'm not seeing that here. That's not to say that he doesn't have bipolar or whatever it is that his defense team ends up saying, if they're going to say anything. That's not to say it didn't that he doesn't have them. It just means that why he did what he did was not associated with any known mental illness, right? Violence is never associated with mental illness at all, but it's certainly not associated with why he committed this crime.
I see. That does make some more sense and puts that more into perspective. I mean, the fact that he was able to pick up and go back to teaching class after this occurred and supposedly kind of keep up with life. for the most part. I mean, what is that? Because one would almost assume that doesn't, you know, have a lot of understanding in the world of psychology that, well, if someone is able to do that sort of thing, then go back to normal life undetected without showing any sort of remorse or strange behaviors. What are we looking at when someone is able to do that sort of thing?
It's extremely complicated and nuanced because we do have some reports. What I think happens is there is an accumulation of very negative and vulnerable emotions within the person that's going to commit this kind of offense. Mm-hmm. It's a buildup. It's not something that anybody just snaps and they're going to engage in a behavior. It's a long process that occurs. It builds over time. And then once the behavior occurs, once that thing that they have been fantasizing about occurs, there's an emotional discharge. Some may call it a catharsis. What I call it is just an emotional discharge where essentially the person no longer feels emotion at all. They had been building up for so long to engage in the behavior that once the behavior is done, there's no more emotion left. And in Koberger's case, if he was the one that committed this crime, what we saw was there were some reports from some of his students that came out that suggested that he hadn't been shaving, that his hair was a little bit more disheveled, right? That he wasn't grading as intensely as he had been grading from before. Those are indications that perhaps he has had this emotional discharge where he did the thing that he wanted to do. And now that it's been done, there's nothing left to feel anymore. There's nothing left to care for yourself anymore. Now, eventually it can come back, as we've seen him recently, particularly in this hearing that happened for when he was magistrated. He shaved again and he sort of kept up his grooming. It can come back, but following that time, following the engaging in that behavior that what had been plaguing his mind for so long, you see just this level of detachment from reality, from emotions, just as a kind of calming down period.
Let me ask you this, because the trigger here, the emotional discharge, if that occurs when he's committing the actual act and then he's off that charge, he's off that high, kind of coming back to reality, what about that period of time from early June, which we've just learned today, where he was beginning the stalking of these women? What is happening there when that decision is made that I'm going to start stalking these people? Is the thought process initially at that moment that eventually this stalking is going to lead to murder? What is happening there in that time window where he's consciously living out his life, really undetected, acting fairly normal to the actual time the crime is committed?
It's very curious in the affidavit that it says that there are 12 times that the cell phone was found and the car was seen in front of the house, that this stalking behavior. What I think is going on is he interacts with these individuals in some happenstance and random way. If we were able to talk to the victims right now, I don't think that they would be able to truly identify when they came across him. He's the kind of guy that vanishes, right? That you recognize him and then the next second he's completely out of your mind. But what happens for him is that potentially there's an accumulation of rejection, a grievance gathering that occurs that builds up over time. He's able to find them part of I think his master's thesis or part of something that was important to him was law enforcement using technology as a process of solving crimes. And so he's potentially someone that understands how to interact with social media and stuff like that. So when he's doing these behaviors, I think multiple fantasies are happening. I think he's having regular fantasies about what it would be like to be a part of this friend group, potentially being, you know, a roommate in this house. I think he's potentially having sexual fantasies, probably not anything that's, you know, sadistic or paraphilic in any way, but just random fantasies about what it would be like to be engaged with any one, if not all, of these individuals that live in this house. But then over time, when he's not able to actually engage in those fantasies, it can become corrupted and it can become aggressive and it can become violent as his mind continues to ruminate over, you know, his entire life's rejections, focusing on these four individuals as the icons of rejection. Mm-hmm. That over time, that those fantasies turn from just innocuous sort of whatever to more aggressive. But again, over that amount of time as well, the fantasies only serve its purposes for so long until eventually that emotional discharge needs to happen. That buildup of fantasy type living can only go so far until you actually have to engage in doing something in order to have that release of anxiety type emotions.
Is he likely someone who hasn't had the ability to feel, it's all speculation, feel healthy emotions or common emotions throughout most of his life? Is this someone who it really takes almost an extreme for him to just even kind of get an inkling of what he sees others seemingly experiencing, empathy, happiness, love, all of that? Is it just kind of like the buttons on mute for him through most of his life, and he's someone who has to kind of learn how to do the motions in order to try and fit in?
I think half of that is probably accurate. There are certainly some researchers and some people who have called themselves mind hunters, for whatever that means, who have indicated that serial killers and killers who would commit acts like this, mass killers and stuff like that, that they don't feel empathy, that they don't have a recognition of fear in others. And I challenge that a little bit. What I think someone like Koberger is good, what I think what is going on with these individuals is that they just don't understand the emotions that are happening. But it's possible that some emotions are much more intense than others, but really is that there is a lack of understanding. There's a lack of an awareness of what is going on, lack of an ability to be introspective, to figure out how what is going on the outside of me is impacting what's going on the inside of me and vice versa, inside to outside.
Is that something that can be learned, though? I mean, lack of understanding, sure. But through most of life, you'd think at some point you would kind of grasp those things if you're capable of. Is he capable of doing that? Are people like this capable of ever truly getting there and understanding what those feelings are and what they mean?
Yeah, it is possible, but it's all regulated by the interactions that you have with other people. It's other people that tell us how we should be interacting and how we should be feeling, what things mean, what. It's through these interactions that we have that if we have healthy and secure interactions, particularly with our parents and friends, right, and loved ones, right, and romantic. If we have positive interactions, then more than likely we're going to understand ourselves better and be able to communicate better. But if for some reason we have an inability to connect with other people, it's going to diminish our ability to connect with our own selves. And so what we see, what we've heard from people who have known Koberger, early on in his life was that he was bullied at first and then became the bully later on. Yeah. This is still someone who is disconnected from interacting well with other people, which necessitates an inability to understand yourself.
Yeah, that's what it seems. I mean, he really, from the day one, I was predicting this is kind of what his profile was going to be like. The inability to interact with others on what would be considered kind of a healthy level, especially with women. This seems like someone, from the stories that we have heard and the allegations that have come out of his attempted interactions with women, not very successful, but also very obvious why in the way that he approaches people from his mindset, almost a lack of understanding of how his actions would be seen from the outside. Does that play into, you know, going and murdering people? Was there something in his mind that he thought he'd be able to outsmart everyone and he'd never get caught? Or do they not see anything beyond what that emotional discharge is going to be once they commit the act? then it's suddenly, oh shit, what do I do now? I mean, he's very seemingly calculated, almost to a genius level leading up to that point. And then afterwards, obviously, there was some ways that he was discovered and caught.
Yeah, anybody who thinks that they're a genius, right, or can commit the perfect crime, which I don't think Koberger really went into this thing thinking that he was going to commit the perfect crime, as some others have suggested. But anybody who thinks that is clearly too narcissistic to recognize that all humans are fallible and mistakes are going to be made. And you're running up against law enforcement that work as a team.
Yeah.
And a team is always going to be able to overcome a single individual. But I think in this instance, if these allegations are to be believed, and if they are found accurate and true, what I think really was going on was that this guy understood that he could not make connections well, and he spent his entire essentially adult life, from college to now graduate school, attempting to understand why he couldn't make connections well enough, from the undergrad degree in psychology to a potential graduate doctorate degree in criminology. What he gravitated towards was an understanding of human interactions, and then later extreme human interactions, probably because he recognized he was having extreme thoughts and extreme emotions that could really only be understood by other criminals. Yeah. And because of that, he spent his time trying to understand why these things even exist.
That was reflected in some of the questions he was asking when he was working on his master's thesis or some sort of study, with the questions that he had posted out there on the university website that has since been taken down. Questions that one could look at and say, well, you know, this is something that one may be asking, you know, who's studying criminology. But some of the questions, you know, almost very self-serving, of trying to understand how an individual would feel step by step. Why did you choose your victim? How did you choose your victim? This or that. Unless it's a real premeditated crime, which this does appear to be, I think a lot of individuals that you're talking to that have committed, you know, fairly serious crimes, sometimes it's not as premeditated as he was almost asking in those questions. It was almost, He was like looking for a guide of sorts on how he should be feeling and taking cues from someone else as he was dealing with those thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with that. A little inside baseball is that I too have completed a dissertation for my doctorate degree. Mm-hmm. And really what happens is when you're asked to start working on that, you find something that draws you in, right? It's got to be something that you want to live with years upon end, with as much research that you have to do and everything. So it's got to be something that you find intrinsically valuable in order to spend that much time with it. And again, this certainly, it's not pathological to want to understand the criminal mind. It's something that I do. It's something that other criminologists do. It's not pathological to do that. What's pathological is attempting to understand yourself by understanding people who would engage in extreme type behaviors.
Was this something where, because of his lack of ability to understand himself, to understand the emotions, if he was feeling any, it's almost like a lost in translation type thing, feeling something, but that part of the mind that then says, okay, this feeling means that feeling means this. Is it one of those things where almost as someone may end up engaging in self-harm, cutting and things of those natures just to feel? Is that something where he may have gone to this extreme because when he found he was stalking these people, allegedly, when he was caught up in this fantasy, that was the only time he was feeling something, and that drive, that desire to feel something so desperately is what led him to then commit a crime like this, allegedly?
Oh, absolutely. Primarily my work revolves around individuals who commit acts of mass violence. So not necessarily a serial or spree, acts of mass violence. That was what my dissertation was on. Mm-hmm. What we've seen is that individuals who would commit workplace shootings, school shootings, they start off with a sense of suicidality. They want to harm themselves for whatever reason that's going on, but they can't. Something prevents them from engaging in that behavior, and it corrupts and it is turned to the external. It is now the society's fault. However they decide society needs to be defined, it's now society's fault that they can't feel well, that they don't interact well, mm-hmm. that they're not performing the way that they should be performing, however they're defining that. And so from the inside, it turns outside. So the things that would have typically been self-harming behaviors and suicidal ideation has now become homicidal ideation. It is certainly possible that an individual who would commit an act like this, whether it's Koberger or not, could have had suicidal ideation at the beginning. But then over time, as grievances were increased, as rejection increased and became more severe, that instead of being self-harming behaviors, it was now, it had to be externalizing homicidal type behaviors.
One of the things that I've been saying again since early on in this, and I may be not completely correct on it, but my thought was this is going to be an incel type character, not necessarily involved in the incel community, but more so the idea that it's society's fault that he's not fitting in. It's women's fault that he's being rejected. It's everybody but him, basically, seeming to be how a character like this plays out. And historically, when we've seen incels commit crimes of this nature, quite often they kill themselves very shortly after or in the process of the crime. Are you at all surprised that this didn't end in his own suicide?
Not really. I understand where people, and I know other friends and psychologists that have come out and said that this was potentially someone that was an incel. I don't think that he had fallen in line and fallen down the rabbit hole of incel type ideology. What I think is particularly because of this, and some people say, well, Elliot Rodgers, he used a knife on his first couple of victims. If someone is going to go ER, and that's how incels describe it on message boards and something like that. If someone's going to go ER, what we're saying is that an incel is going to then engage in a performance type crime. They're going to record it. It's going to be, you know, in public. There's a lot of things that are going to be involved with the overall showiness of mm-hmm. the crime. Essentially, they want society to recognize that they have been harmed and now they are putting right what went wrong. That's not really what happened in this case. Sure. At least there hasn't been any recordings being made. There hasn't been any posted on 8chan or 4chan or whatever it is, dark web message boards. There hasn't been any of that. So I'm not surprised that this didn't end in suicidality. I'm thinking it's a little bit more in line with these four individuals wronged me. So I'm going to make these four individuals pay. And I think that's kind of the extent of the thought process when it comes to whoever engaged in this. And in this instance, it, according to the affidavit, which seems pretty outstanding, is Koberger.
With that being said, that those four individuals wronged me, is that in this case, and we'll probably learn this soon, if they did in fact have any sort of interactions, and it obviously doesn't have to be anything major. It could have been, as I've said before, you know, maybe he hit on one of the girls and she rejected him, just as I'm sure those women get hit on every day and reject many people every single day. So it really wasn't a big deal to any of them. But to him, was it like a last straw type scenario where I'm going to show you, a control thing where he didn't have control of getting the date or getting the attention from women? And so he wanted that urge then came out. I guess my question, I've kind of gone off the rails there a little bit, is were they more so a representation of women in general that he's not had luck with his entire life? Or do you feel that this was something where it was those specific people and something about their specific actions that made him target them specifically?
I think it's both. I think he needed a reason to engage in an extreme type behavior. That's where they're representing something much larger, right? That they're representing all women that have ever rejected him. But I think and I agree with you that it's most likely something innocuous, that something happened with one of them or while all four of them were together, that all of the four would have recognized as being just kind of random and not important, but he saw it as super important.
Yeah.
So it's certainly possible that this scenario would have happened where he attempts to hit on one of them, gets rejected. She goes to back to the friend group. They all laugh, whether it's laughing that she had just rejected him or not. What he sees is these group of individuals laughing, and what he connects it to was him being rejected.
Yeah.
That's certainly a scenario in which someone could have these kinds of violent and aggressive thoughts if they start linking it to higher rejections, more rejections that they have faced earlier on in their life.
Let's talk a little bit about his family. This is something where I can't imagine being the parent of someone where you find this out. From everything we see on the outside, a family that seemed to have it fairly together. We don't know a ton about them. There's two sisters involved in psychology and the study of humans. He in the study of criminology. So all, you know, fairly educated, very intelligent on what they're all doing. If you're the parent in this sort of situation, or the parents, and as we just learned today, it was a genetic DNA match that helped prove that it's a 99.9996% chance that this is him, because it matched the knife sheath with his father's DNA, that the 99.999% six is his father. What's going through the mind of a parent when, you know, you just spent the holidays with your kid, you just went cross country with your kid? I'm guessing the parents had no idea on this. How does one begin to wrap their minds around this and cope?
I honestly have no idea. I think that they're probably still in shock. I think they're probably still in disbelief. I don't think that they ever thought any of their children were capable of engaging in any kind of behaviors like this. But I also think that they're trying to walk a fine line, because with all of them being engaged in, with all of the children being engaged in areas of practice in which they understand human nature, mm-hmm. it sounds to me like this family probably spent a lot of time discussing their feelings and describing their feelings and really being open and communicative about their emotional states. So I think that they understand that, yes, they need to be there for their son, but they also need to acknowledge that their son potentially has engaged in a behavior that hurts so many different people. It's a very fine line to walk that I wouldn't be surprised if we don't really hear from the parents moving forward, because it'd be too difficult of a line to walk when you want to be there and not believe your family member capable of this, while acknowledging the severity of what happened.
I mean, that's severe trauma right there in itself, just being the parent of someone that committed these sort of things. Historically, when you look at cases where someone's child, adult child, has committed a crime and the parents have to kind of come to terms with it, and they do eventually accept and don't stay in denial about it, do we often see parents look back and say, oh, there was a lot of signs that we really didn't recognize or missed or weren't even aware of, as you kind of go and run the rewind button on life?
Oh yeah. But I think everybody's going to do that. Anybody who interacted with Koberger, if it ends up being that he is convicted of this crime, mm-hmm. anybody who interacted with him, from his family to his siblings to even friends that he had as a child, all of them are going to look at themselves to say, was there something that I have missed? How am I guilty of putting him in a place? I think a lot of people, particularly his parents, are going to have a lot of survivor's type guilt,
sure.
right? Thinking that they somehow did something wrong, when the truth is that if he did this, he wanted to do it.
Yeah. I mean, with something like this, the question begs to be asked, and I don't know if there's really an answer to this, is it almost seems to take them to strike, to act out in order to be stopped. I mean, is there any way to get ahead of something like this, if the person is being very covert and not You know, it's, they're basically keeping this 100% to themselves.
You know, I have to say that yes, that there is a way, because there's always signs of someone that is struggling. There are always signs. It's just, are we in a position as an individual and as a society, are we in a position to recognize those signs and act appropriately? I think that's the key, is that while there's a lot of talk of mental health in society right now, we're still struggling with how we should be interacting with those individuals who are struggling, right? With some cities saying that they're just going to automatically put people into psychiatric hospitals against their will, right? Where I think that we still have a long way to go to being able to discuss mental health and mental illness in a clear and objective way that is empathic and understandable. That I don't think we're quite there yet, but yes, I do think that there was a sign that someone, if they were keen enough, could have said, no, I think you need a little bit more help from what's for some stuff that's going on with you, and provided some kind of intervention.
But isn't that a very, very difficult thing to execute, though? Even if someone does recognize signs, but the person has committed nothing, there's really no, there's no like hit list or anything of that nature. It's just they're recognizing behaviors. They're recognizing patterns of behavior that are rather disturbing. Honestly, if the parents did recognize that, or somebody recognized that and said, you need to get some help, it's still almost completely up to that individual to get help, is it not?
Oh, it's nearly impossible. You know, the old joke of, you know, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? One, but the light bulb has to want to change.
Exactly.
Right. And so it's like, even if any of us had the ability to understand and read another person's mind, the person has to want to change. The person has to not want to engage in those behaviors. If they don't want to do it, then they won't do it. So it would be almost impossible, even in the best circumstance.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to be the very disturbing thing. Even if you have solid evidence or something, the person still has not committed the crime. They've made these threats there. They maybe not even made threats, or just they've said things that are disturbing. You couldn't do anything. Even if you called somebody, you called police, you called some sort of mental health, they, if there's not a crime committed and they're not actively at that moment in time in some sort of psychosis, there's literally nothing that can be done, correct?
Correct, right? Because we don't adjudicate people's behaviors based on the thoughts that they had at the time. I mean, we have engaged in hate crimes laws and stuff like that to sort of, but those are extreme types of laws, right? Yeah. Those are extreme type behaviors, right? We don't know what someone is capable of doing until they do it, even if they've made claims. Once they've made the claim, then we have to start taking it seriously that they're going to engage in the act.
Unfortunately, that's the scary part. We hear about this so often, where the signs are all there, but it takes someone getting killed before anything is able to be done. Just your opinion, is there anything in that world that could change, or that should change, to put more control in the hands of a concerned family member or a loved one or a friend that sees clear, dangerous signs of an individual that could stop something? Obviously, you're going to be trampling on people's rights to a certain extent if we go down that road, but is it worth for us as a society to explore that with so many things of this nature happening every day?
I think you hit it right on the head, which is it's up to society to decide whether or not that they view that as appropriate, because the truth is we've trampled on plenty of rights already, right? That we believed that we had, but we actually don't, given whatever court cases and Supreme Court, we've trampled on rights already, but we did so because as a society, we thought it was important to do so, to put limitations. And I do think that it is possible. Making sure that our mental health providers have adequate reimbursement for the services that they provide, to make sure that laws that are in place for someone to be put into a psychiatric facility for emergency detention include psychologists and not just limited to medical professionals. I do think that there are things that we could do, but society has to decide that it's okay to cross that line in order to do it.
John Della Torre, licensed psychologist. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insight on this case. That's going to wrap up this episode of the University of Idaho Murders podcast for Killed for What. Please do press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and conversations on the case as we continue to cover it day by day. You can get an ad-free experience if you'd like on Apple Podcasts. There's that option there for you. You'll also get access to our other podcast, True Crime Today, and all of that content ad-free as well. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod. I'm Tony Bruschi. Until next time, for all of us here at True Crime Today and the University of Idaho Murders podcast, For Killed For What. Thanks for listening.